And welcome to Transformational Women Radio. This is your host, Hannah Anam. Each week, we interview women who are transforming their businesses, their teams, and their communities, and we get their nuggets about how they're creating this transformational change. There's really four key traits that separate transformational leaders. They're incredibly purpose-driven. They're innovative change agents. They know how to deeply engage people, and they're inspiring in terms of their core set of values. And today we have the pleasure of welcoming Sandy Gordon. Sandy, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Hallie.
So let me share with our listening audience a little bit about your background, Sandy, which is hugely impressive. I'll read a little bit from your bio. Sandy is the Vice President of In-Flight Field Operations for Delta Airlines. And in this position, Sandy, you have responsibility for 20,000 Delta flight attendants. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct.
So we're going to invite all of our listeners to call in and give you their Delta stories, right?
Oh, and I'm sure there are plenty of them they can give.
But I know, but we were talking a little bit earlier. You said that you have some good news to report.
I do.
And so we'll get into that a little bit.
That'd be great. Mm-hmm.
About that. But let me share with you, it sounds like you've been with Delta for 21 years and you started your career at Delta as a flight attendant. So wow, what a soaring career.
Big
no
change.
Pun intended. That's great. Mm-hmm. And beyond your certainly your Delta experience, it seems like you have had a really great community background as well. You serve on the board of directors for Big Brothers and Big Sisters of Metro Atlanta, and you volunteer with the local Girl Scouts
yes.
troop.
Yes.
And in your spare time, you're also involved in various other civic organizations, including the National Sickle Cell Project. So you got your undergrad from Hampton University, is
correct.
That correct?
Yes.
A Bachelor of Science degree in finance, and you are a native of Atlanta and still reside in Fayetteville, Georgia?
I do. Been down there for about 6 years now.
Okay, and you have a husband and two children, 12 and 17.
12 and 17.
So you've got a lot of juggling that you're doing. 20,000 flight attendants and, two kids who are teens, right?
Yes.
Almost teens. Yes.
Yes, yes. It's a full-time job, but they keep me grounded.
That's great. Mm-hmm. That's
absolutely
great. So why don't we get started and tell us a little bit about your story.
Okay.
You were born here in Atlanta, but give us a little bit of background.
Yeah, well, actually, Hannah, I was born in Germany, in Frankfurt, Germany. So
oh, wow.
I am the product of an army man.
Okay.
And but my father and my mother, we moved here to Atlanta in the early 70s.
Okay.
So Atlanta really, I call it home. It's
okay.
where I was raised and I'm very familiar with. Actually, I went to school in the southwest side of Atlanta and graduated from Benjamin Elijah Mays Math and Academy, Science Academy. And then after that, I went to Hampton University, as you stated. The only thing my parents said outside of there was just a general expectation that we were going to go to school after high school was that my mother in particular wanted me to leave the city. And she really even pushed to look further than the state of Georgia. Great schools here in Georgia, nothing against those. But her push was really about me trying to get some independence
mm-hmm.
and to live a little bit on my own and recognize that there were places, just equally as wonderful of places to live
mm-hmm.
as Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
And so Hampton caught my eye. We did a quick tour of a couple of schools that had accepted or offered me entrance, and Hampton University was one of them. And I have to say, I've never regretted that. It was a beautiful campus, a beautiful location. Though when I went to Hampton, my degree was originally going to be in accounting.
Mm.
And it's what I thought I wanted to do because I have a strong like for math and problem solving. And so I figured that's where I wanted to be. And very shortly into the second year at Hampton, I started to learn a few things about myself. And I also took a few steps to better understand what it would take and what it would be like to be an accountant and what kind of job opportunities career would be in front of me. And I learned that I really like people. I like interacting with people. I started to recognize that I have what I think is a gift or talent for communicating with people and motivating, inspiring people to do better.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't sure I was going to be able to tap into that passion and that gift through
being
the field
accountant?
Of an accountant.
Really?
Nothing.
You didn't get that?
Got some great friends that are accountants if they're listening. But so a great counselor told me, well, you could do finance, and that way you have the best of both worlds. You can take that degree and do other things. So I did that. Came out of school in 4 years with a bachelor's of science in finance. Came back to Atlanta. And the first thing my father said when we were taking the bags out of the car is, you need to get a job. Now, the one thing he didn't say is, you need to find your career right now. But he said, at the very least, you need to get a job.
Yeah.
Delta and Atlanta, just like Coca-Cola, mm-hmm. it's just synonymous with Atlanta. And back in the early 90s, which is when I graduated, Delta was just really in a very good place with its employees, really viewed by the community as a strong employer mm-hmm. that you would be proud to work with, mm-hmm. that would take good care of the employees, and the employees do a good job and seem to enjoy doing what they did. So I went to Delta and was called back for a second interview in the field of supply chain or procurement. I did not get that job. Mm. As a matter of fact, at the end of the interview, the young lady asked me if I would sit out in the waiting room for just a minute, and I thought to myself, oh, this is great. They're going to call me right back, and they're going to tell me I've gotten the job. And they came out and said, what did you think about being a flight attendant? And we've got an interview class going on right now for flight attendant, and we think you might be great for that. And I had never thought about becoming a flight attendant. All I knew was my dad said, get a job. Mm-hmm. So I went and just kind of went with the interview process. And who knew, at the end of the day, they offered me a position in the upcoming flight attendant class. I do remember saying, can I get back to you on that one? Because mm-hmm. it was just so different and wasn't in my plan at all. But I think, you know, as you learn a little bit more about me and my career track, you'll find that's pretty much been my mm-hmm. career. Mm-hmm. It really hasn't been that well orchestrated or planned by me. It's been a series of opportunities put in front of me. And with each opportunity, I looked at it as, what can I learn? Mm-hmm. What am I going to get out of this? And what can I give to this? Mm-hmm. And if I could intelligently answer both of those questions and felt good about it, mm-hmm. then I'd take the opportunity. And that's how I became a flight attendant, because I viewed it as, here was a chance for me to see the world. Here was a chance for me to get my foot in the door at Delta. And here was a chance for me to do something different. And so I went through 5.5 weeks of flight attendant training. I must say it was extremely intense. I know that sounds kind of strange. You think, how difficult is it to become a flight attendant?
Right.
But it is very intense. Flight attendants, when you think about anything that can happen on the ground, mm-hmm. it can happen 30,000 feet in the air.
Mm-hmm.
And in many situations, the difference between life and death has been our flight attendants mm-hmm. for many customers. Mm-hmm. And so we learn CPR. We learn how to fight fires. Mm-hmm. We learn how to be counselors, lawyers, doctors, all kinds of mm-hmm. things on board the mm-hmm. airplane mm-hmm. to assist our customers. And so 5.5 weeks and a daily testing with an average of 90. Mm-hmm. I became a flight attendant, and I thought I'd see the world for a little while and then go get a real job.
Mm. So let me stop you mm-hmm. here, because I think I want to come back to
okay.
a couple points that you made that I really want to reinforce.
Okay.
You mentioned that, and I think so many young women who are graduating now or young men mm-hmm. Think that they need to have their career completely orchestrated, you know,
yeah.
and they get very anxious when it's not, because yeah. they really have no idea about what they should be when they grow up.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want to come back to what you said mm-hmm. when, you know, you said at the time, you know, you had just graduated with a brilliant finance degree.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you were interviewing for a job in supply chain.
Yes.
And then somebody said, well, we think you're going to be a great flight attendant.
Right. And so
that's like a huge detour, right?
It is.
So you asked yourself, you mentioned two questions that you asked yourself. Repeat those questions for our listeners again.
I think the first question I always ask myself is, what's the opportunity in this for me? What is there for me to learn, or what's the challenge in front of me? And you know, it's interesting as I reflect on my career. That is one of the questions I've asked with every opportunity that's been put in front of me, from becoming a flight attendant to becoming the vice president of in-flight service. Mm-hmm. And if I can answer that, mm-hmm. and there's genuinely something for me to learn, to grow, mm-hmm. To grow from, then I, you know, that answers the first part. The second question is, what can I bring to this? Mm-hmm. Because it's not only what you can take, but what you can give. And that's a very important part, I think, of any job selection, mm-hmm. because you've proven that you clearly have something to give mm-hmm. to someone, mm-hmm. but you have to know what that gift mm-hmm. is as well, mm-hmm. In order to ensure you're measuring your own success in the position. And so for me, again, if you think back to when I stopped to reflect on the opportunities that would be in front of me as an accountant with mm-hmm. an accounting degree, and it mm-hmm. doesn't mean that that would be all there was, but in my, you know, limited knowledge of the world at 18, that's what I thought. I said I knew I needed to work with people. I wanted to interact with people. And if you think about the job of a flight attendant, it absolutely is that. And mm-hmm. that's one of the things that I feel and felt then and still feel today, that I'm very good about, good in being able to deliver, mm-hmm. and I'm very passionate about. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. so I knew that what I could get from the flight attendant was to see the opportunity to see the world, something I hadn't done much of. And the opportunity to get my foot in the door at Delta. Mm-hmm. And while it wasn't the route I'd originally mm-hmm. planned mm-hmm. To enter the world of finance at mm-hmm. Delta, it was an opening, mm-hmm. and it was an opportunity. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, one way is better than another if mm-hmm. the other doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm.
what I'm hearing you say is, when you see an opportunity in front of you and you've got the answers clear in your mind to those two questions, the thing to do is seize the opportunity.
Absolutely, without a doubt. Seize it and embrace it, and be enthusiastic about it. I really enjoyed being a flight attendant, and I flew as a flight attendant for about 5 years. Uninterrupted. And around about a 4.5 year mark, I started to feel I traveled, I'd seen the world, a little of the world. But I started to feel that I needed more of a challenge for myself. And it's at that point that I began to pursue other opportunities within Delta, and even within the in-flight division. And I, over the course of 4 years, I learned how vast the in-flight division was. It's not just flight attendants. It's the scheduling of flight attendants, which is significant.
A problem solved.
It is a problem to be solved. If you think about it, you know, the scheduling of the flight attendant is an employee relations piece, because that governs their compensation as well as their flexibility in their time off. And you've got the operation that you have to endure. And the weather can absolutely play a part in that for our schedulers. And then you also have catering. In-flight is responsible for the provisioning on board the airplane. And so the onboard supplies and some of the products that are delivered to our customers and served to our customers, as well as programs to just govern. So there's a human relations part. So as I learned more about the business of in-flight, I realized there were lots of opportunities just right there in front of me. Mm-hmm. And having served as a flight attendant for 4 years, 4.5 years, I definitely felt I understood the component and the largest piece of in-flight, which is the flight attendant aspect and what it takes to be one. Mm-hmm. So I did. I stayed in in-flight and I worked as a flight attendant, and then began to work my way through the division as a supervisor, manager. I led various programs and even found myself in scheduling, leading the scheduling division. I entered into that department in 1999. It was a very challenging time for us at that point, and was in there through 2001, September 11th. 2001, which
must have been quite the challenge.
It was, you know, as you know, that was not only a challenge for Delta, but it was for every airline. It was the only time that any of us know of where the airline industry came to a halt.
Give us the insider view of what happened.
So what was unique for me in this is on September 11th, I was actually in New York conducting some personnel meetings. And we were hosting those meetings at the JFK airport in one of our meeting rooms, which had a window, and you could look out of the window and see the buildings down in the city. And I recall it was about 9 o'clock in the morning, somewhere at that time frame. And I remember a flight attendant saying, I see smoke in the city. Something must be on fire. Must mm-hmm. be pretty significant. And I looked. Well, right about that time, we had beepers at that point, pagers that could give very limited messages. And the first thing that happened was I had a cell phone call, and it was my brother-in-law who wanted to know where I was. And it was very garbled, and I told him where I was, and he just said, Sandy, stay by your phone. Something's going on in New York. Well, right after that, the beepers all started going off, mm-hmm. and we were getting 911 messages. And when you've got, one of the things you learn as a flight attendant is customers on board a plane look at your facial reaction or response when there's turbulence mm-hmm. in the air, or if the pilot says something that, mm-hmm. you know, they may not be familiar with. They'll look to you, and they look to you, and based on how you look back mm-hmm. at them, mm-hmm. that will determine their level of anxiety or emotion.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, that's true of leaders as well.
That is very true. Another example of something that absolutely a lesson learned. And so in this moment, that is exactly what it was, is when I realized we had a problem, there were other leaders there, and their beepers go off, all of the flight attendants begin to look, because you can tell something strange is happening. And remaining calm was important. And that took over, that level of, first and foremost, let's take care of the employees. So we called, we learned that we were, you know, in a very serious situation, weren't still very clear on what was exactly happening, but we knew it was a security-related issue. Moving the employees, canceling the meeting, moving the employees downstairs back to our place of work, and then trying to secure a phone line. Securing a phone line back to the headquarters was the biggest challenge we had at the immediate time, because everyone in the city and in the world pretty much was calling somebody mm-hmm. they knew to check on them. And it took us quite a bit of time to get an outside line. Mm-hmm. But once we did, for me leading scheduling, my priority became trying to understand what our course of action was going to be. And obviously, and when the government said immediately set down all planes, then the challenge became trying to identify where our planes were mm-hmm. located, because our people were on those planes. Mm-hmm. And that was the greatest challenge. The other challenge was, again, continuing to keep the line of communication open. And so fortunately for me, I reached one of my employees, but I reached them on a cell phone mm-hmm. and they patched me in, connected me to our central system via speakerphone. And that literally became the course of communications for 24 hours. And so it was, you know, a big portion of their work was trying to make sure that we continue to have power to that cell phone. I know it sounds very simple, but mm-hmm. It was an important thing, because we needed to have continuous conversation with the system in Atlanta. And
I'm curious, as you know, in an extreme crisis situation mm-hmm. where you have so many different things on fire at mm-hmm. the same time, how do you prioritize what you give attention to? And many of it, I mean, I think much of it is also your own, you know, like, how do I get home safely yeah. myself, right? Yeah. There's that other component
that other
of that. Yeah. Because my family's worried about me, and I'm in New York City.
Right, right. So for me.
And we didn't know at that time if there'd be other events happening in New York that.
Correct.
You know,
I think, Hannah, some of it is. Some of it is common. Some of it is just you set the priorities based on the information that you have. I wish I could say first you do this and, mm-hmm. and then you do, you know, step two. I think for me, the first thing is to try to just get whatever information I can about what is taking place. And then at some point you just begin to be confident in the decisions you make, because you're never going to have all the information. You could, you know, analysis paralysis. You could analyze a situation forever or wait for that last little piece of information, and it never comes, and you don't make a decision, and then create other challenges. Once I secured the line to to the scheduling department, it was to say, we need to understand, we need to have somebody who can tell us where our planes are. You all need to pull rosters. We need to know who's on every flight. And then the other thing I said was, and can someone call my husband? Can someone call my husband? Here's the number. Tell him I am fine. Mm-hmm. And I can't talk to him, but I am fine. Mm-hmm. And that was important because I'm mm-hmm. sure he was worried. Mm-hmm. And then from there, you get to work mm-hmm. and you just take it step by step. You keep people calm. You respond in a very logical approach. And so I think by keeping people busy and focused and always sounding like we had a plan, even when I really wasn't sure what the plan was going to be.
Yeah.
Because.
So what was that famous quote? You know, keep calm and carry on.
That is very true. Because you don't always know what the plan is. Sometimes you're kind of making it up as you go and as mm-hmm. information comes to you. But probably the biggest thing for me that works well is just thinking about putting myself in the other people's positions. So I put myself in the position of the flight attendants. If I were out there in Halifax on a runway because they can't enter you into the country and you're on a plane with, you know, 200 plus customers, all scared, you don't have the information. And what was supposed to be a 3-day trip now looks like it could very well be 5, 6, 7 days. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're worried about your own family. Mm-hmm. Then the one thing I would want to do is I'd want to be in contact with my company mm-hmm. and I'd want someone to be in contact with my family right. and let them know that I'm okay. And so that became the first set of priority is establish a command center that could accomplish those two things. Mm-hmm. We need to be able to get word to our crews regarding what's happening. So it means, you know, even if it means contacting countries and having them run a note to mm-hmm. the airplane and mm-hmm. hand it up through mm-hmm. a window to the pilot so mm-hmm. they can pass it along. And then equally worrying about the employees who were there manning the desk and working in our scheduling department and making sure that they understood, yes, we were going to have extended emergency hours, mm-hmm. But being responsible enough to say, and at the end of that extended shift, they need to leave. They mm-hmm. need to separate, mm-hmm. go release, you know, and relax and then come back mm-hmm. so that they could come back recharged. Mm-hmm. Those kind of thoughts mm-hmm. actually helped keep others very busy, mm-hmm. had a purpose, could move on and not focus on emotions mm-hmm. and get a little carried away with ourselves in some mm-hmm. of those times. And honestly, because we did that, the team that was responsible for contacting flight attendants, we realized the best way to do that was through conference calls. Mm. And we put out phone numbers via CNN and every other news network we could find. We just asked them if they would scroll numbers and we, put out conference and held a conference call that evening. We were able to get a line out that evening and held a conference call and thousands of flight attendants called in and we just answered whatever questions we could answer. Mm. And we also said, the biggest thing we need is for you to stay with the airplanes mm-hmm. because people were saying, I want to rent a car. I want to drive home. Mm-hmm. And we thought when we are ready and able, when the skies open and we can fly, we have customers who want to get home too. Mm-hmm. If we don't have flight attendants, we can't fly. Mm-hmm. We need you to stay put. And because
so
of that.
So how do you convince people, right? I mean, that's almost like leading people in war.
Yes,
right?
It is.
I mean, you basically are telling them to put service before self.
I think the greatest thing is, one, being able to say, I know you're scared. I know you have family at home. Being able to say, I have family at home, too. Mm-hmm. But the fastest way for us to get you home, because we don't know when the skies are going to open and car rental places, you know, mm-hmm. they're out of cars things like that.
Yeah.
Is for you to stay put. We know where you are. We know you're safe. Mm-hmm. And we know how to reach you and take care of you. Mm-hmm. If you're in transport someplace else, we don't know where you are. Mm-hmm. We don't know. And we can't convey mm-hmm. that to your family. Those types of just reassuring words help people feel calm. Our ability to say, we've contacted your family. Here's a phone number for your family to call to get an update. Mm-hmm. And so we staff desks where mm-hmm. their family members could call. Doing those types of things allowed Delta to be the first one back up in the air flying. When mm-hmm. they opened the skies, we literally were the first airline to put planes in the sky. And we're very proud of that. And we, you know, I know everyone was doing the best that they could at every airline. But our employees at the end of the conclusion of that incident and once things were operating as normal, our employees talked about our handling of that, and they compared it to what some of their friends and colleagues at other airlines had said to mm-hmm. them about how it was handled. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things I would say about Delta. Its values, its corporate values, are very much aligned with mine, taking care of people. The bottom line or the financial, you know, assessment is not the only thing we consider in our decisions. And sometimes, while the financial outcome may be more positive and drive us to one decision, if it has a negative impact on the people, I have seen us say no to that. Mm-hmm. And that it kind of reinforces my value system in the way I was reared, which is you're considerate of others and mm-hmm. you think about other people. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that you don't make hard decisions, but because you've thought about the individuals that are supporting you and serving you and being a part of your company and things of that nature, it makes it so much easier for you to stand in front of them during hard times mm-hmm. and convey to them that you're in this together and why they should, you know, or why they would want to help rally behind the company or support what's even a difficult decision. And so over time, we've continued, and I've continued to try to lead in that way to such a degree that I believe when we have been in hard times, we've been able to convey a sense of need of support from our employees, and they've rallied around us.
Mm-hmm. What an amazing learning experience. Mm-hmm. So as you look back on that experience, many of us, I think, as human beings and leaders, you know, we wouldn't want to wish some of those challenges on anybody, right?
Right.
And yet those are, you know, our deepest trials are some of our most incredible learning experiences.
True.
So
true.
As you step back and reflect back, what are some of your deepest lessons learned, you know, from that experience?
Oh, that's a great question, Hannah. I would say communication is key. And I know that sounds cliche because mm-hmm. people say it all the time, but it is very true. And it has to be authentic and genuine. Mm-hmm. I am constantly humbled by the fact that I have the position I have. Because again, I didn't set out to be the vice president of in-flight service for Delta Airlines. 20,000 people across the world, globe, you know, reporting into me. It is a humbling fact. And with that, though, it is important to me that the employees feel the same sense of pride in working for Delta that I felt when I became an employee at Delta. And there was a great amount of pride. And I associate my role, I look to my role as a key part of that. And so I think about the way I communicate with people. And that was a lesson learned from even September 11th, is as difficult as it was to hold a conversation with flight attendants who are in, you know, who are distressed about, you know, how quickly could they get home and their fears and concerns. And we all were. And not have answers. I didn't know when the airline was going to mm-hmm. be back up running, but I need you to stay there. Mm-hmm. I think it is, I've taken that with me in some other challenging situations. You know, for example, the first time Delta ever furloughed mm-hmm. employees. Mm-hmm. And instead of shying away from it and taking the road of communicating through written communications, I added to written communications face-to-face meetings. At a time that was going to be very challenging because some of the financial distress we found ourselves in, you know, we had to, as leaders, own some poor decisions. Mm-hmm. And standing in front of the employees and answering the hard questions and accepting that which was mine as a leader of Delta's to own was extremely challenging. And it's not something you'd ever want anyone to go through in their career. However, again, when I look back on that, I learned so much about how to communicate with people and how to deliver difficult messages. Mm-hmm. And I also had the benefit of seeing the positive, you know, putting distance between that and, you know, today. Yesterday, you mentioned earlier, we got some great news at Delta. We did. We received word from J.D. Power, you know, the customer satisfaction award provider,
survey company, right.
Thank you, mm-hmm. That Delta was the one who received number 3 in all of the North American carriers, was rated number 3. Now, while we're not number 1, which we would like to be, we are number 1 among the majors. And so that was really important. We were also the only ones to see positive improvement in our survey ratings year over year.
Wow.
Among the majors. And it's hard work.
Right.
And so we're very proud of that.
Yeah.
But more importantly, I think we're proud of it because we think it's a testament to where we should be, which is viewed as the hometown airline, the mm-hmm. one that our employees are proud of being a part of. And we think it's a first sign that says we're getting back to that position and that place where people want to buy mm-hmm. tickets on Delta. They're mm-hmm. excited about flying Delta, and Delta employees are excited about being a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an honor to be a part of that. And so when you think back on all the difficult times that we've come through in the various conversations, for me, the greatest lesson learned in all of the most challenging situations I've had at Delta is the need to communicate and the need to be able to communicate across all levels. To be able to sit in the boardroom and challenge, be the only female in that room and challenge some decisions and be able to take a position that may not necessarily be the one of popular opinion and see that positively through, mm-hmm. and equally be able to communicate to the front line with a sense of empathy in some challenging situations and celebrate when it's appropriate and reward. And so having that diverse communication style is really important.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's very important.
Yeah. So I heard you actually talk about 3 things that that I took away from the conversation. I want to just summarize and make sure that these still resonate with you through the 9/11 experience, but also some of the other experiences that you talked about. I think one that is really important is the ability to put yourself in others' shoes.
Correct.
You know, really understand what is it that is going through their heads.
Exactly.
Whether that's somebody at the board
mm-hmm.
level or somebody who's a flight attendant that's stuck on the tarmac, you know,
exactly.
in the middle of 9/11. The second you talked about is authentic and genuine personal communication.
Mm-hmm.
So not only written, but also personal voice to voice, so people can really understand your intent.
Mm-hmm.
They can get to know you and to be able to have a voice in delivering, you know, what could be a controversial or a difficult message.
Correct.
And being able to take that ownership
mm-hmm.
For that message.
Yes.
And the third piece that I heard you talk about was this notion of really learning how to lead in uncertainty, where you may not have all the data and you may never have it, but that to start to feel confident
yes.
in some of the decisions that you're going to make and,
mm-hmm.
and not, you know, analysis by paralysis, there's just no room for it.
There's none. And some of that comes from experiences. And so again, while it's a very short career to have reached, you know, vice president level, and I know that when I've looked at other people's bios, I also know that there's a wealth of experiences that I've had over those 20 years that lead me to be able to make the decisions and feel comfortable in the decisions mm-hmm. I am making. And mm-hmm. it kind of gets back to what we said initially. I've had people ask me to mentor them, and I think they sometimes come looking for, tell me the shortest amount of steps I have to take to get to your position.
Mm-hmm.
And when I share with them that I didn't have this well-charted path that I could hand over to them and say, here's what you need to do. I can see the look of frustration because
mm-hmm.
they're looking for that.
Yeah, they're looking for the magic bullet.
They're looking for the magic bullet. But in the end, it gets back to what we were saying earlier around the opportunities that present themselves and feeling comfortable in them. Because I also think people, you have to enjoy what you're doing. And so for every position I've had in my career, I have enjoyed it. And when it was time for me to take on a new challenge, I knew it. There was no question about it. I knew I had learned probably the most I was going to learn in that role. And even as I looked for the next opportunity, I continued to deliver passionately and enthusiastically in the position I held. And that's a very important piece for me to, if I could share with people as I talk to them about advancing their careers, it's absolutely, continue to invest in yourself and look for those opportunities, but remain always committed to the position that you hold and what you're doing mm-hmm. at that time. Mm-hmm. Because you'd be amazed when we came through and closed our integration or the merger with Northwest. I'd been in this position now about 3.5 years, and I thought, well, maybe it's time for me to look for something else. What else could top being an executive and through bankruptcy at the company and then the largest merger ever and being successful, et cetera, at achieving that?
And now receiving some of the customer
satisfaction. And now receiving the customer satisfaction.
Ratings.
Right.
And, which, by the way, I mean, it's when you have 20,000 yes. flight attendants mm-hmm. And any one of them can destroy the customer experience and yes. it takes, you know, a lot to yes. earn it back.
Very true. Very true.
Then it's definitely a huge challenge.
It is. It is. But as I get to this point and you wonder, well, what else could there possibly be to challenge you? For me, the past few years has been about coming out of bankruptcy and merging the company, very operationally focused. And now we're at a place where there's a little distance between us and the rest of the industry because everyone else is where we were 2 years ago. And so it's our chance to kind of put some distance between us and the competition. And this is where the creativity and the fun around service and developing the people comes. And I'm really excited about that. And so for me, that's the newness in the role. Same job, same title, but it's reinventing it in the sense of my focus and my priorities now center around customer service and ensuring that we are, enhancing our customer service and looking for creative ways to help our employees be able to reinvent a service that we've done for years. It's a technology. We are investing in technology for our flight attendants to make that experience more special for our customers on board the airplane, which is new and exciting. We have cultural. So with the merger, we introduced Delta at a broader range to the Asian the continent and Asia. And so over we have flight attendants over there in China and Japan and Korea that bring a cultural newness to us at Delta. And you take that and you take that opportunity to expand our flight attendants' understanding of cultural differences and appreciation for cultural differences, because our customers don't just fly over to the United States and then fly immediately back directly. They fly within the United States. And so on a flight from Atlanta to Birmingham, I can absolutely have all kinds of diverse persons on board the airplane. Mm-hmm. And I want our flight attendants to know how to interact mm-hmm. and how to say we're a global airline. Mm-hmm. Still with the, with the North American flair, but we are a global airline. Mm-hmm. Airline mm-hmm. and that's really important. Well, that's so a lot really, of cultural influence. So it's fun.
So what are I loved what you said about and I think so many of us are always looking for the what's next, and what you talked about is, look, have fun in what you're doing now mm-hmm. and there's lots of opportunities for you to reinvent the role to make it exciting and challenging every single day.
Absolutely.
And so that you can be passionate about it. So what are some of the bold goals that you're setting for yourself, and what are some of the new learning opportunities that you have in front of you?
Wow, that's great. I think for me professionally and right now, because the goals always change, I really am very focused on being a key influence in Delta reestablishing itself as the hometown airline. Mm-hmm. And not only externally, but internally.
Mm-hmm. So what does that mean? Explain to our listeners, what is this notion of the hometown airline?
So if you know anything about Delta's history here in Atlanta, it was once known for being one of the top companies to work for if you were in Atlanta. Just a company where the employees took pride, unique pride. The best way I can describe it is in 1987, the employees purchased an airplane for the airline, and it was called the Spirit of Delta, and it was a 757, and it started with about 3 to 4 flight attendants and pilots getting together and saying, this company has just been so good to its employees, we want to do something for it. And so they purchased an airplane, unheard of, hadn't happened since among any other airline. And so it was almost, people tend to joke about it, but they called it a family,
mm-hmm.
the Delta family. Mm-hmm. And we lost a little of that as mm-hmm. we went through the challenges mm-hmm. and the business cycles mm-hmm. and trying to understand our business and reinvent ourselves. And so we're now in a place where the opportunity is ours to reclaim it. When we were back in the 80s, Delta was number one in customer service, and our customers felt it. And there's a strong correlation between employee satisfaction and customer mm-hmm. satisfaction.
That's right.
And so my bold goal is to take the in-flight division to lead that charge, because the flight attendants spend the most time with the customers. They are the face of the Delta brand. And so they can undo what may have not been a pleasant experience at the beginning of the travel ribbon.
Of course.
And make it a positive
one, yes.
I was
sharing with you, some of my experiences.
Right, right. You had one where it wasn't, you were disappointed.
The technology wasn't there, yeah. But the flight attendants went way over and above to try to make it up.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what we want. We want, we know things aren't going to be perfect.
We want them to be the differentiator.
But we want them to be the differentiator, because right. at the end of the day, everything else can be copied or imitated by another airline. But the people piece is the part that we own mm-hmm. squarely, and mm-hmm. it's an opportunity for us. And so taking the time to make that and have the in-flight division lead that would absolutely be a jewel in my crown for me. It really would be. Personally, my bold goal is to balance all of it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as you
mm-hmm.
said, I have 2 children, a husband and a dog, and they're all, my husband's very accommodating, very flexible, very supportive of me having my career. At the same time, I'm supportive of him having his, and we want to raise our children with the same values that we were raised with and the time that our parents both spent with us. So
So now what you're really looking for is 36 hours in a day, right?
Exactly, because I tell you, 24 definitely in doing it.
Right.
But it is, it's work. It takes a conscious effort to do that. And it means giving Delta 110% when I'm with Delta and giving my family 110% when I'm with them.
Mm-hmm.
And then somewhere in all of that, finding a little time for myself. If you asked me, have I mastered that? I will tell you no. If you ask me, do I continue to try? I will tell you yes, and I do. And
that's
that
great.
Is my goal, is to try to find that balance.
Right, mm-hmm. right. So, you talked about what an enormous challenge it is in leading the airline to really be the number one in terms of customer satisfaction, and
mm-hmm.
that so much of it is driven by flight attendants.
It is.
That being the differentiator, that they can truly be the differentiator in terms of the customer experience.
Yes.
And that's a huge challenge. And that requires transformational leadership, which I really is a huge personal interest of mine. And I do believe that women in particular can be have the potential to be amazing transformational leaders. And a lot of it is due to their ability to really communicate.
Yes.
and empathize mm-hmm. and be able to put, themselves in somebody else's shoes and be able to deeply engage others, which
sure.
is what is required as a leader.
Mm-hmm.
So talk about, in terms of the work that you're doing, and you're obviously leading people who lead these 20,000,
correct.
Flight attendants.
Yes.
What have you learned about deeply engaging others?
The one thing I've learned is there's not one thing that will motivate or engage another individual. I have all of my leaders are very different, and they all are motivated by different things. But I do believe having a very clear vision and being able to communicate that vision is what will help your leaders then define for themselves what is that motivating piece. Mm-hmm. So it's where I've seen the difference between success and failure. Oftentimes there's a vision, and there's an individual who has that vision, and they are the only ones who know of that vision. Mm-hmm. And while it's so clear to them, it's not to the others, mm-hmm. who have to be the workers, mm-hmm. the people who can mm-hmm. absolutely make it come to fruition. And there's an art to doing that. Mm-hmm. And I believe it's one of those things you continue to, I continue to work on it. But I do believe it's very critical. And your ability to do that to leaders at various levels. So I have many of the in-flight leaders, the frontline leaders, come from the front line, as I did. Mm-hmm. So they start as flight attendants, mm-hmm. and then they show an interest and they come in. We rely on those people to carry such heavy messages, you know, the quarterly earnings or maybe a position relative to, you know, even union representation or things of various topics, very diverse fuel. You know, we purchased a refinery. We expect our flight attendants often ask our frontline leaders about things of that nature. And we expect them to be able to speak to all of those topics to some level of, you know, understand with some level of knowledge and understanding. It is really important that they understand, those leaders understand what it is you're trying to do for the division and what you value. If they have the answer to those two things, then I think they can make all the other pieces come together, because mm-hmm. they then understand how to deliver mm-hmm. messages because they know what you value. You mm-hmm. have the same value system, or you're very clear. But when our CEO arrived, Richard Anderson, he introduced what he called the rules of the road. They were actually the rules of his garage that he and his wife, Sue, introduced to their children. Mm. And it's do no harm, you know, always tell the truth, try your hardest, don't give up. Basic things that we all know, and I'm sure our parents instilled in all of us, and maybe with different anecdotes and stories and quips, but nonetheless, those values. And Richard has a wonderful story of our founder, CE Woolman's desk was in our museum. Mm-hmm. He asked to have the desk brought to his office. He wanted to use that desk. Mm-hmm. And in that desk, in the very back of the drawer, was a handbook that CE Woolman had presented years ago to the employees. And in it, very similar statements. Mm-hmm. Take care of your employees. Employees will take care of you. Mm-hmm. Those types of things. Mm-hmm. Well, he put all of those together and call it the rules of the road. And the rules of the road are what we live by, and it's just kind of our, here's what we value. We are always tell the truth to each other, even if it's difficult. Mm-hmm. Be thoughtful of people, be empathetic. Mm-hmm. And so when your employees understand that that's your value system, mm-hmm. In that, many of them will find their own value system aligns with that. And that makes it always very clear. When I have a situation, I have to, you know, when a frontline leader has a decision to make, they know that we care about the people. They know we are guardians of the financial aspect of the company, too. So they know they have to balance that. But they know it's not one or the other. Mm-hmm. It's a balance. They know that if you make a mistake, you own that mistake. You learn from that mistake and we move on. Mm-hmm. We don't hold it over mm-hmm. you. Things like that matter, mm-hmm. especially to someone who's newly stepping into leadership. Mm-hmm. They matter to people who've been in leadership for a very long time, too, who, you know, may find themselves, while the decisions get larger, the consequences are greater.
Of course.
We sometimes have to remind ourselves it's okay to take that risk and make that decision. And even if we aren't successful, we learn from it and we move on, and it's not held over us. So I think being able to articulate, here's where you're trying to take the division. And then couple that with the confidence that you have around your value system mm-hmm. and your rules, then that is what I believe helps people support and motivate and deliver what you're trying to do and helps you be successful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So One of the other things that you strike me as somebody who is certainly very passionate about the work that you're doing, and also fairly purposeful about it. So I'm curious, in a lot of the work that I do, I always talk with leaders about, and my clients about, what's their personal leadership brand? Mm-hmm. You know, what is it that they stand for as a leader that surely shines through in the work that they do? So would you have a sense of how you would articulate that for yourself?
It won't be as well articulated as if I was a marketing major in branding, but I think I would say I'm an inclusive leader. Mm-hmm. I respect everyone's position, mm-hmm. And what they have to offer. Mm-hmm. And so oftentimes I will take a little bit longer in formulating a final decision or direction that we're going to take, because I want to talk to one or two more people, mm-hmm. who bring a different perspective. But in doing that, I have found I make better decisions, I can defend my position, mm-hmm. and I gain the respect of many different people along the way, mm-hmm. At all levels. Mm-hmm. And that helps me, mm-hmm. Be able to manage and lead. And so I think inclusiveness is really what I'm about. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter if you're senior to me in title or I support you, mm-hmm. And lead you, that I want to hear what you have to say. Mm-hmm. And I found that people seem to respect that.
That's great. So, Sandy, do you have any parting words of wisdom for all the folks that are listening in?
As I was coming here, I was a little intimidated by this, because again, I go back to, I think that there's an expectation you've got some great insight and wisdom to give. And really,
well, I shared a few.
I look at that and I just say, I'm sharing what has been shared with me, mm-hmm. along the way. Mm-hmm. And through all of that, I think it's just being true to yourself, knowing your strengths, knowing your areas in need of a development. And if there were one thing that I could say I've learned over the years that has really been helpful to me, is don't be afraid to surround yourself with people that are smarter than you. Mm-hmm. And just be confident, because you know yourself, mm-hmm. that it's okay to surround yourself with, mm-hmm. people that are smarter than you. And I do that. Mm-hmm. And I'm, you know, I just have a great team that supports me. And as a result, we get the job done.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Hannah, for
a great afternoon of great insights and experiences, and what a treat to really hear the story of 9/11 from an insider's point of view, and what a privilege to be able to learn through many of the trials that you've had the opportunity to learn and sharing that wisdom with us.
Thank you very much. We appreciate the time being here.
Great. This is your host, Hannah Anam, and join us again next week when we're going to talk to yet another fantastic transformational leader.